welcome to another edition of the Health First Show. I'm your host, Dave Fuller, and we're going to be talking with Dr. Steve Bearer about his book, get this one, Exercise Will Hurt You. And in the second half of the show, we're going to be talking with homeopath Bryce Wild. But before we do that, here's Reg with the health news.
Curcumin, the patented turmeric extract formulation from Arjuna Natural Extracts, has received a U.S. patent for its use as a potential treatment for Alzheimer's disease. The patent describes the unique combination of beneficial curcuminoids and turmeric essential oil in BCM95, as well as its enhanced absorption and bioavailability. BCM95 curcumin has already undergone human clinical trials in patients with Alzheimer's disease at Chinese University of Hong Kong under Professor Larry Baum. It was found to be highly beneficial in preventing further cognitive decline, reducing amyloid beta plaques, one of the major causes of Alzheimer's disease, increasing vitamin E levels in the body, and enhancing curcumin levels in blood. Under pioneering researcher Professor Ralph Martins in Australia, BCM95 curcumin is also undergoing two other human clinical trials in patients with Alzheimer's disease and in subjects at risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Although low-dose aspirin may curb the risks of heart disease and colon cancer, a new large study suggests the downsides appear to outweigh the benefits for many women. For women younger than 65, researchers found taking low-dose aspirin for years lowered the risks of heart attack, stroke, and colon cancer by a small amount, but they also found the benefit was countered by an increased risk of major gastrointestinal bleeding, serious enough to land a woman in the hospital. The picture looked better for women aged 65 and up. Researchers report aspirin boosted their risk of bleeding too, but the benefits against heart disease and colon cancer were bigger. The study appeared online December 4th in the journal Heart. And finally, a new study says weight loss surgery patients who don't take prescribed vitamin and mineral supplements could put themselves at risk for vision problems. Digestive system changes caused by the surgery can reduce nutrient absorption from food, the researchers explain in a recent issue of the journal Obesity Surgery. The study authors reviewed the available research and found nutrient deficiencies after weight loss surgery can lead to a wide range of eye conditions. They include night blindness, ulcers, scarring of and changes to the cornea, involuntary eye movement, paralysis of the eye muscles, and dry eyes. The researchers say a lower intake of vitamins A, E, and B1 plus copper are especially concerning because they help with the normal functioning of the eye and optic system. They found vitamin A deficiency was most strongly linked to eye problems after weight loss surgery.
Well, our next guest has an interesting topic. Our first guest today is Dr. Steve Bearer. He is the director of Neuroscience Institute and the former chief of the Division of Neuroscience at Abington Memorial Hospital. He's written a book called, Get This, Exercise Will Hurt You. And if you're an occasional jogger, skier, or yogi, or you do yoga, you're going to want to listen to this interview. Dr. Bearer, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, what first got you interested in looking at exercise as a source of illness?
Well, it started out mostly as an essay on my injuries, which are many over the years, both in exercise and playing sports. I've never been a very good or disciplined or regular exerciser, and I started the book more or less as a tongue-in-cheek essay on why I didn't like to exercise, and why you can hurt and how you can hurt yourself doing it. And from there, it generalized into a book about how exercise can harm you and how bad it can be if you are not careful, if you overdo it, if you don't pay attention to signals that your body is giving you.
Now, you compare, in your book, you talk about comparing exercise to riding a motorcycle. What are the significant similarities?
Well, I use the analogy of what's the likelihood of you being hurt. And with a motorcycle, it is probably in excess of 100%. 100% of motorcycle riders will have an accident. Most of them, thankfully, are minor. Mm-hmm. They fall over, they spin out, they skin their knee, they do something that's not a life-threatening injury. And most motorcycle riders have more than one of those. Same thing with exercise. If you exercise long enough and actively enough, you're going to hurt yourself. It's only a matter of time, and I would defy anybody who does exercise on a regular basis or plays sports on a regular basis to tell me that they've never hurt themselves.
You know, I do a fair bit of exercise, or have over the years, and I would say that, you know, I've had a number of injuries, including some of the ones you're going to talk about in the, or you talk about in the book, and we're going to get to. But are you saying that people should be couch potatoes?
No, not at all. Nowhere in the book do I say that exercise isn't good for you.
Yeah.
What I say is that it will hurt you. And you can mitigate the chances of that if you are smart enough to understand what your capabilities are, if you pay attention to what your body tells you, if you do develop pain or some other sign of an injury and don't ignore it, if you put some common sense ahead of ego and machismo, and if you understand that when you're 60, you're no longer 30. It's those sorts of things that I talk about in the book. It's really a book about educating yourself as to how exercise can be bad for you and how it can harm you, even though it doesn't mean you shouldn't exercise.
Yeah.
You still need to stay in motion.
So, you know, you were, it looks like you're the head of neurosurgery at Memorial Hospital. As a neurosurgeon, you know, you must have seen evidence of people getting hurt as a result of injuries, sports injuries.
Yep.
And did you ever look at any result, any tests as that showed the benefit of sports as well?
Well, I don't. That's not the purpose of my book, and that's been done so often that there's no reason for me to reiterate that or to repeat that. And again, I don't say that anywhere that exercise isn't good for you.
Right.
What I talk about in my practice, and it started out as a compilation of my injuries, but I put a lot of my practice experience into the book as well. The most common and most significant injury I see is head injuries. And I see tons and tons of head injuries from sports, concussions all over the place. And even though they are more in the news nowadays and people seem to be more aware of them, I've been seeing concussions for 35 years. And I've always known that they're pernicious and that they can cause trouble. All this information is coming out now. It's not really new to those of us who have taken care of concussions and head injuries, especially in youngsters who play scholastic sports. It's just that now everybody's talking about it. The serious injuries that can be life-ending or life-altering, I see as well, certainly not as frequently as the concussions, which I see virtually every day. But I've certainly seen my share of severe injuries as well playing sports. They're not all car accidents and motorcycle accidents. They are sports injuries as well as spine injuries. But there's also the wear and tear that goes with aging and continuing to participate in sports and exercise at a level that may be inappropriate for your age, especially in the spine. I see a lot of spine-related degenerative changes that are exacerbated by people's lifestyles because they're not paying attention.
And what kind of sports really exacerbate these type of injuries in seniors or in older people, I guess?
Well, in the elderly, you're obviously not going to play contact. You're not seeing contact sports, but they play golf,
right.
They play tennis, they swim, they walk. Some still bike ride, some still climb and hike, and all of those are good things, as long as you're not piling on, as long as you're not developing a problem that you're not paying attention to.
Right.
And then the problem just gets worse and worse, and then you end up in my office.
I was watching my daughters play basketball the other day, and I was sitting beside a medical doctor, and he was saying that he was at a soccer game. I'm not sure if this is this summer or a different summer, and they called him onto the field because he was just watching a game or he was there at the fields, and they said, you know, somebody's down there knocked unconscious. So he walked over, and as he was going over there, he was helping, you know, making sure, you know, the ambulance was coming. So he was just making sure the guy was breathing. And the guy said, one of the guys who was standing around says, you know, I just barely touched him. They were playing soccer. And I guess he went up with his foot near the guy's head. He said, I just barely touched him in the head. The guy went down and he was knocked out. And then the kid's parents came over. This wasn't a kid. It was 23. And he said, oh, don't worry about that. That happens to him all the time. What significant contribution can these kind of injuries make to having problems in the brain for long periods of time.
We've certainly learned over time, and again, it's become very much in the news lately, that repetitive concussions can be very pernicious. A concussion will set you up for another concussion, especially if you haven't allowed it to heal. But if you've had a concussion, you're fully healed, you hit your head again, it can create a concussion with a lesser injury. So that example you gave may be exactly that. This is a person who's had repetitive concussions, and because now they're set up to have future concussions with minor injuries, all they need is a tap on the head to get another concussion, whereas before they would have had to take a knee to the head and be unconscious. Mm. So there is this domino effect, so to speak, where one concussion will set you up for another one and another one after that. Now, there's a more worrisome syndrome called second impact syndrome, where if you have a concussion and you don't allow it to heal and you go back into contact sports and you get another concussion before the first one is healed, that can be extremely dangerous, and that has actually led to deaths. A second concussion in the face of the first one not healed sets off some sort of cascade that we don't understand entirely well that creates severe swelling in the brain that can lead to a rapid rise in intracranial pressure and can cause death.
Dr. Baer, you know, how long does it take for a concussion to heal?
Varies. I've seen them last as short as a couple of hours, and I've seen them last as long as months. And then there's a really rare type that never really gets better, and people develop a kind of chronic situation, a chronic syndrome where they have ongoing headaches and difficulties. But on average, I would say they last anywhere from a couple of weeks to a couple of months.
A couple of years ago, I was snowboarding. I took up snowboarding in my 40s, and like you said, it's probably not a good idea.
No, it's not bad. You just have to be careful. I hope you wear a helmet.
I was wearing a helmet, but I had I was going quite fast, and I had a quite a bad accident. I banged my head. There was a lot of people standing around, so I was a bit embarrassed. So I got back on the chairlift, you know, went skiing, but I had a concussion, and I stopped after the next run. But I had a concussion for about, you know, I want to say like 3 or 4 weeks. And then, you know, the headache was starting to go away. I went tobogganing with my kids, and we went over a little bump just tobogganing on this little hill. Went over a little bump, hardly even... didn't do anything, you know, didn't bang my head or anything, just shook it. And I had a headache for 2 more weeks. And it kind of went on like that for a series of months until I realized I got to be very careful.
That's a perfect example of what we were just talking about, where one concussion sets you up for another one with a lesser degree of impact. You may have actually even had that second concussion before the first one was fully healed. Although the hallmark of a healed concussion really is absence of symptoms. If people develop a concussion and they develop what's called post-concussion syndrome, which is that constellation of symptoms that persist after the initial concussion, and that's most commonly the most common symptoms are headache. That's virtually universal in all post-concussion syndromes. And then there's various other things that can occur, like difficulty concentrating, some unsteadiness, some sensitivity to sound, to light, difficulty focusing your vision, difficulty listening to what people are saying and understanding what they're saying. And there's a whole variety of symptoms, ataxia, difficulty with balance, vertigo, et cetera. If you look on the internet on post-concussion syndrome, the list of symptoms is about 3 pages long. The absence, or as those symptoms disappear, your concussion is getting better. And when they're gone, your concussion is done. It's over. Healed. There's no real good imaging study or test that can tell you when your concussion's over. It's really a clinical hallmark.
We're talking with Dr. Steve Baer about his book, Exercise Will Hurt You. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be finding out how you can reduce the incidence and severity of sports injuries.